Hello, welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 28th. I'm your reader, Dagna. Today's mini editorial is written by Ralph Webb of North Sioux City, and he writes, "After enduring 8 years of fireworks in North Sioux City, I have appealed to the North Sioux City Council to remove fireworks from residential neighborhoods, only to have it fall on deaf ears. I have posted this sign in front of my yard, alerting my neighbors of my status in hopes they may be sensitive to myself and others in the community that have wartime experience." Again, this was written by Ralph Webb of North Sioux City. Our first article today has a headline of "Greenwell Responds to Transparency Comments Presents Timeline." Sioux City School Board President Dan Greenwell said Monday the search for an interim superintendent and associate superintendent did not lack transparency, in spite of recent comments from fellow board members suggesting the opposite. Greenwell presented a timeline spanning from February to June of the superintendent and associate superintendent search process, specifically highlighting when information was presented to the entire board. Greenwell said there hasn't been enough information communicated on the timeline, but it has been a transparent process. "It has been complete and transparent this whole time, both in the closed sessions and in public," he said. Board members Perla Alicorn-Flory and Monique Scarlett previously claimed that Rod Earlywine's selection for the interim superintendent position lacks transparency. Scarlett and Alicorn-Flory accused a committee of board members of not following an agreed-upon plan. The pair said the board never agreed on a single candidate before it was presented to the board for approval. When a contract to hire Earlywine was presented to the board, the two dissented. Alicorn-Flory and Scarlett said they could not approve Earlywine's contract because district staff and the public were not given an opportunity to offer input into the potential candidates, and the agreed process was not followed. Alicorn-Flory also said the selection of an associate superintendent lacked transparency. Angela Bemis was approved on June 13th to serve as the district's new associate superintendent. The board approved Bemis as a senior director beginning July 1, with the condition that she obtain her superintendent license by July 13. After Bemis obtains her state license, the board will be asked to change her job title to associate superintendent. The senior director position was listed with hundreds of other job changes in a human resources report as part of the board's consent agenda. Alicorn-Flory asked for more discussion about the associate superintendent job, admitting she did not realize earlier that the position had been included in the human resources packet. "This is a chief academic officer, and I think we need to be very transparent with the community about it," Alicorn-Flory said. On May 9th, Greenwell read a letter in which Earlywine recommended Bemis as the associate superintendent. Greenwell had disagreed with Alicorn-Flory and Scarlett's assertions that the processes lack transparency. He said the comments and discussions have told him that overcommunication is key in the future. In March, the board approved a $15,000 contract with the Omaha firm of GR Recruiting, which specializes in recruiting for educational leadership roles, to help with the search for a new superintendent. At the same time, the board also decided to appoint an interim superintendent to give time to community and district input on the selection of a permanent superintendent. In the future, GR Associates presented a projected timeline to board members that laid out the dates and times for the superintendent search, Greenwell said. Greenwell said the process will start in early or mid-September, and the board will decide how to proceed with community input. He said the future process has not been changed due to the transparency comments. Council approves water main replacement. Aging Pierce Street water main has suffered several breaks. The Sioux City Council voted in a split decision Monday to adopt plans, specification, form of contract, and estimated cost for the construction of the Pierce Street water main replacement. The council approved the resolution by a vote of 4-1. Mayor Bob Scott cast the lone no vote. "We could have bid it a lot earlier. Shame on us. Why do we bid projects that have to be done in May? The world bids this type of work in October. We knew in October this had to be done," Scott said. "Now I'm going to get to pay higher water bills because of stuff we should have gotten done a lot sooner than what we did." Last Tuesday, a 110-plus-year-old cast-iron water main broke near the intersection of 5th and Pierce Street. The water main has suffered at least 3 breaks in the past year or so, with 2 of those being directly in front of the Orpheum Theater. JEO Consulting Group Incorporated of South Sioux City completed plans and specifications for the project, which includes the replacement of the water main and street paving for utility replacements. The engineer's opinion of probable construction costs for the work is $1,525,000. The city is ready to advertise the notice to bidders on Wednesday. A public hearing will be held on July 11th. Bids will be received on July 12th. There is a $100,000 incentive to complete work in Stage 1 of the contract prior to November 23rd and another $100,000 incentive project completion before July 3rd, 2023. The project has an early start date of August 3rd and a late start date of May 15, 2023, is expected to be completed within 60 working days. The project is being funded with American Rescue Plan Act dollars. After the latest break, the Orpheum and Elf's downtown library lost running water, and the fire suppression systems of the theater and the Francis Building were down. A stretch of Pierce Street was reduced to one lane. A year in Germany. Sioux Center student picked for prestigious study program. Sioux Center High School student Claire Opdahl is one of 250 students across the United States selected to spend a year in Germany. Opdahl has been selected for the Congress Bundestag U Exchange Scholarship, a U.S. Department of State fully funded exchange program. Students who participate in the program learn about German culture by living with the host family and attending a German high school for a year. Opdahl began searching for a study abroad program in August 2021. She wanted to see other experiences outside of Sioux Center and wanted to travel. The main problem, most programs are expensive, upwards of $16,000 a year. A lot of people see that and stop there, but I was like, I'm not going to stop there. I'm going to see if there are any scholarships, she said. There are a variety of scholarship-based study abroad programs, but Opdahl had previously taken a DNA test to find out her genetic history. She found out that she is 70% German. When she found the government-funded study abroad program to Germany, she thought it was a perfect fit. That's why I was first interested in the program. Opdahl had to write 5 short essays, a letter to the potential host family, 2 recommendation letters, and research information on local government representatives. In November, she did a virtual interview and then heard nothing for several months. 5 or 6 months later, Opdahl received confirmation that she was a semi-finalist and shortly after was accepted for the program. Opdahl's mother, Connie, said she felt it was meant to be. She said it's not going to be an easy year, but the whole family is supportive of her. She said Claire likes to see outside of the box and wants to branch out from traditional student direction. Opdahl said it doesn't feel real yet. She leaves August 16 for a language camp where she will spend a month before meeting her host family. She will live in rural Germany as a junior at Max Ernst Gymnasium School. Her host family has 3 sisters, but one will be studying abroad in Texas while Opdahl is here. They really like traveling, which I hope to be able to do, she said. Opdahl has immune thrombocytopenia, an autoimmune disorder. She said it limits the activities she can do, such as athletics, but has been in remission for 3 years. Since she has been restricted in the types of athletics she can do, it has pushed her to follow other activities in life. The Congress Bundestag Youth Exchange was started in 1983 and is available to students, recent graduates, and young professionals in 11 states. Before even going on the trip, she has been creating new connections because of people in the community that have been to Germany or have a connection to Germany. The program was created by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. The department promotes international mutual understanding between the people of the United States and people of other countries through a range of academic, culture, private sector, professional, and sports exchange programs. It is administered by Youth for Understanding USA, which also offers a wide range of opportunities for people to see the world. Council okays license requirement for Sioux City after clubs hours. The Sioux City Council unanimously voted Monday to adopt an ordinance that will require after-hours clubs within city limits to be licensed. Over the past several years, these types of clubs, which operate between 2 and 6 a.m., have been the site of multiple shootings and other criminal activity. Under the ordinance, after-hours clubs owners will be required to pay $175 to apply for or renew a license, which will be valid for 1 year. As a condition of the application, owners will consent to allowing the city's inspection services and fire departments to inspect the premises to confirm compliance with city code standards. Police officers will be allowed to enter the clubs during operating hours to confirm that alcohol beverages laws are being complied with. This shows that you prioritize our citizens' safety. That's something that's truly important, Councilman Matthew O'Kane told the Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller and Assistant City Attorney Steve Polstoka before the vote. O'Kane asked Polstoka how many clubs are currently operating in the city and if they will be notified about the ordinance. Polstoka said, "To my knowledge, there's one after-hours club currently operating. I suppose we could send them a notification sometime." He also noted that clubs have 180 days after the ordinance goes into effect before needing to be in compliance with it. No one under 21 will be permitted in an after-hours club during hours of operation. The clubs cannot be located in areas of the city that are zoned residential or operate within any premises that has a liquor license. Under the city code, consumption of alcoholic beverages on premises accessible to the public is prohibited from 2 to 6 a.m. on weekdays and Saturdays, and from 2 to 8 a.m. on Sundays. An after-hours club in violation of the ordinance will be declared a nuisance, and the owner of the premises at which it operates at will be guilty of a municipal infraction, according to the proposed ordinance. Its license will be suspended if the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor committed a specific criminal incident at the club or recklessly allowed one to occur there or was ordered to abate a nuisance at the club. An after-hours club's license will be revoked if the licensee or the licensee's employee, agent, or contractor committed or knowingly allowed another to commit murder or voluntary manslaughter. The license will also be terminated if the club's license had been suspended within the previous 12 months and the licensee or the licensee's employer, agent, or contractor once again committed a criminal incident or knowingly allowed one to occur there. The city manager will issue a letter of an intent to deny, suspend, or revoke an after-hours club's license. Licensees will be allowed to request a hearing to contest any denial, suspension, or revocation within 20 days of the date of the letter. In the early morning hours of October 10th, officers were dispatched to a shots fired call at an after-hours club at 427 Pier Street, where they found a male victim with a life-threatening gunshot wound in his upper body. A short time later, three other victims arrived at hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. The shooting was the result of a dispute between two groups of people at the club, which has since closed, according to police. Three finalists named for Iowa Supreme Court opening. The Iowa Supreme Court's next justice will be one of three finalists announced Monday by the state's Judicial Nominating Commission. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds will choose from among the three finalists, who are, according to a news release from the state court system, Alan Heavens, a Northeast Iowa judge from the 1st District from Garnavillo and a former Clayton County attorney, David May, an Iowa Court of Appeals judge from Polk City and a finalist for an Iowa Supreme Court vacancy in 2020. William Miller, a lawyer from Dorsey and Whitney in Des Moines and a previous applicant for Iowa Supreme Court opening. A Sioux City judge, Patrick Tott, was one of the original five applicants. He did not make the list of finalists. Reynolds has 30 days until July 27th to choose the next Iowa Supreme Court justice. Once she does, five of the High Court's seven justices will have been picked by Reynolds. The latest opening is being created by the retirement of Justice Brent Appel, who is the court's last remaining member appointed by a Democratic governor, Tom Vilsack, in 2006. Appel was also retained by voters in the 2016 judicial retention elections. Appel this summer turns 72, the age at which Iowa judges are required by law to retire. Five candidates applied for the opening. All were interviewed Monday by the 17-member State Judicial Nominating Commission, which is comprised of 8 lawyers and 9 members appointed by Reynolds. And we now have a South Dakota story with the headline, "A Former Attorney General Ravensburg Presses Ethics Case Against Noam." Former South Dakota Attorney General Jason Ravensburg, in his first public comment since being removed from office last week, appeared before a state's ethics board Monday to press for an investigation of fellow Republican Governor Kristi Noem, the person he blames for his impeachment over his conduct surrounding a 2020 fatal car crash. As Attorney General, Ravensburg last year filed a pair of complaints against Noem to the state's Government Accountability Board, alleging she abused the powers of her office by interfering in a state agency as it evaluated her daughter's application for a real estate appraiser license and by misusing state airplanes. The board, which is comprised of retired judges, has not decided whether to investigate Noem and is working with an attorney to evaluate the merits of the complaints. Ravensburg appeared at the Government Accountability Board's meeting for the first time since he initiated the complaints last year and said he was ready to provide additional information. He made it clear he thinks an investigation could have far-reaching consequences for Noem, who is running for a re-election after a first term that vaulted her to national prominence. She's widely considered to be a White House aspirant in 2024. "I'm not going to let this just drop. I think that they should pursue it, and I do believe that, ultimately, the House will pursue it," Ravensburg told the Associated Press, suggesting that Noem could also face impeachment for her actions. The former attorney general denied that he was out for revenge against Noem, although he does blame her for his removal. Noem and Ravensburg became political enemies after he struck and killed a pedestrian in 2020. Noem publicly called for Ravensburg to resign and later pressed the legislature to impeach him. The House eventually did, and the Senate last week convicted him of 2 charges, committing a crime that caused someone's death and malfeasance in misleading investigators and misusing his office. Ravensburg blamed emotion and political pressure for tilting the Republican-controlled Senate against him and said Noem sought his removal because he had filed the complaints to the Government Accountability Board. "I think that among these 2 complaints, and there's other scandals that she's involved in, that she did not want the information to come to light," he said. Noem spokesman Tony Mangan declined to comment on the board's proceedings or Ravensburg's remarks. The board has tapped Sioux Falls attorney Mark Hay, who primarily specializes in business and health care law, to help evaluate Ravensburg's complaints. Hay also has experience arguing before juries, administrative boards, and licensee agencies. This Associated Press reported last year that the governor held a meeting in July 2020 that included her daughter and key decision makers in her application for an appraiser license just days after the agency moved to deny the license. A Republican-controlled legislative committee concluded that Noem's daughter, Cassidy Peters, got preferential treatment. Noem has rejected that finding, saying her daughter followed the same process as other applicants. But the agency's former director, Sherry Brenn, told the legislative committee last year that she felt intimidated at the July 2020 meeting, where she said Peter's unsuccessful application was discussed in detail and a plan was formed to give her an unprecedented additional chance to show she could meet federal standards. Noem's office has said the plan was in the works before the meeting. Peters got her license 4 months later. Shortly after that, Brenn retired under pressure from Noem's cabinet secretary. She eventually received a $200,000 settlement to withdraw an age discrimination complaint. Ravensburg's other complaint was sparked by a report from Raw Story, a news website. Noem in 2019 used state airplanes to travel to events held by political organizations, including the National Rifle Association and the Republican Jewish Coalition, even though South Dakota law bars their use for anything other than state business. Noem defended the trips as part of her work as an ambassador for the state. The board's consideration of the complaints began last year and has happened entirely in private meetings. It could either investigate the complaints and potentially hold hearings or dismiss them entirely. The judges will meet next on August 3rd. We now have a story from the Sioux City School Board. Construction trades building bid accepted. Estimated completion in November 2023. The Sioux City School Board has approved the construction of space for construction trades education. In a unanimous vote, the board accepted a $3.8 million bid from the H&R Construction of South Sioux City. The project will total $4.15 million with architectural and engineering fees. The Construction Trades Building will be attached to the Harry Hopkins Center on Highway 75 and is intended to provide a controlled environment for students to complete various building projects. The 12,000 square foot building would be added to the west side of the facility and provide space for students to build houses or other small buildings, said Tim Paul, the district's director of operations and maintenance. The board approved two additional alternatives that were included in the bid price. Director of Operations and Maintenance Tim Paul said one alternative was to add chain hoists in the building. H&R Construction quoted $31,000. The other alternative was two different company options for temperature control. H&R Construction quoted a low option of $53,000 from Star Controls. The other alternatives in the bid that were added in the proposed project in case the bids came higher than estimated. The alternatives were to change to a cheaper insulation, eliminate painting of the existing building exterior, and different concrete masonry. Paul said they did not want to move forward with those alternatives. Matt Basie of the Sioux City architectural firm FEH Design previously said the building will include two construction bays, one classroom, storage space, and restrooms. He said the project was part of a master plan developed 5 or 6 years ago for the Harry Hopkins facility. The project will also clean up the appearance of the Hopkins facility, which houses food services and the district's current trade school. The facility is named for Harry Hopkins, a Sioux City native and member of the administration of Franklin D. Roosevelt. The project completion date is set for November 1, 2023. The project will be paid from elementary and secondary education relief funding. Field of Dreams TV series awarded grant. The state of Iowa will invest in the development of a Field of Dreams television series, new trail construction, and new Des Moines lakefront amenities. Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa Economic Development Authority on Monday announced $16.5 million in grant money awarded to four projects in the first round of funding through Destination Iowa, a program supported by the Federal American Rescue Plan Act. The $100 million program, announced in April, invests in transformational attractions that will bolster the quality of life in Iowa communities and attract visitors and new residents, according to a news release from the governor's office. Projects awarded grant funding so far are $6 million to Universal Television for the development of a Field of Dreams television series. Filming will be based in several Iowa communities, including those in Polk, Mahaska, Boone, and Clinton counties. Plans include set construction of a ball field and refurbished farmhouse in Polk City. $7 million to the Siouxland Regional Trail System to develop 100 miles of continuous trail projects connecting Sioux City, Lamar's, Hinton, Merrill, and Sergeant Bluff. The project includes the Cone Mountain Bike Park, the 18.5-mile Plywood Trail, and a 4.3-mile Lus Hill Scenic Trail. $2.5 million to Polk County Conservation for the Easter Lake North Shore Project. According to a news release, the project will provide an accessible recreational hub for rowing, swimming, fishing, and other water sports. $1 million to Dallas County Conservation to complete a 4-mile trail connection linking two existing trails in central Iowa, the Raccoon River Valley and High Trestle Trail. Once completed, the project will create a 120-mile continuous loop of trail. The Gazette reported last month the 7-part Field of Dreams prequel series will be streamed next year on Peacock, taking a deeper dive into the backstory and characters from the beloved Kevin Costner film. Dyersville, the location where the 1989 baseball movie was shot, however, is not on the series docket, as it will be filming around the time Major League Baseball returns to the site for a regular season game between the Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds on August 11th. On August 9th, the Cedar Rapids Colonels take on the Quad Cities River Bandits in minor league action. The TV series will use local crews, suppliers, and vendors for construction, catering, transportation, and set decoration. Renovo Media Group of Clear Lake will bring equipment and expertise. Musco Lighting and its subsidiary Iowa Sports Turf will help light, design, and construct the baseball field. IEDA will continue to review applications as they arrive through December 31st or until funding runs out. Agencies team up in Estherville to rescue bulldog from sinkhole. The city of Estherville came together Monday to rescue a bulldog from a sinkhole. Estherville police officers responded to a report of a missing elderly bulldog named Tupelo at 3:10 a.m. According to a statement from the police department, the caller said she could hear her dog barking in a ravine behind her house in the 20th block of Orchard Lane. The officers and the dog owner searched the area and eventually found Tupelo in a cement drainage tile. The area around the tile had created a sinkhole approximately 3 feet in diameter and about 3 feet deep. The statement said the dog was wedged into the cement tile. Estherville Fire Chief and Emergency Management Coordinator Travis Sheridan, Estherville Firemen, the City of Estherville's Electricians and the Street Department, Emmett County's Secondary Roads Department, Dr. Arlen Omfett from the Estherville Veterinary Clinic, and the neighbors assisted in the efforts to dig around the tile to free Tupelo. At 6:24 a.m., Tupelo was successfully removed from the tile and found to be in great condition. He was returned to his very happy owners, according to the statement. Lamar's man gets federal prison for gun crimes. A Lamar's man who illegally possessed firearms, stored them for a convicted felon, and provided a false statement to a firearms dealer was sentenced on June 24th to more than 3 years in federal prison. Jason Blau, 46, pled guilty to being a drug user in possession of firearms and providing a false statement to a federal firearms dealer. Law enforcement executed a search warrant at Blau's home in January of 2021. They seized drug paraphernalia, meth, thousands of rounds of ammunition, and 17 guns, including rifles, shotguns, and handguns. Blau had obtained and stored guns and ammunition from Robert Hansen, a convicted felon. Blau had previously purchased, with a false statement, two AR-15 rifles for Hansen, who was prohibited due to criminal history. U.S. District Court Judge Leonard T. Strand sentenced Blau to 45 months in federal prison, in which he must serve 3 years before being released. Sioux City man charged with arson. A Sioux City man was arrested Monday in connection with a vehicle fire. Sean Keem Goodman, 27, is charged with one count of first-degree arson, a Class B felony. At 12:56 p.m., Sioux City Fire Rescue and the Sioux City Police Department were notified of a car on fire in a garage in the 1800 block of Virginia Street. According to a statement from the police department, witnesses reported seeing three people next to the garage where the fire was reported. Officers found the subjects a short distance away and detained them, as it has been determined that arson was the cause of the fire. The two other individuals were released without charges. Siouxland man sought on felony strangulation charge. The U.S. Marshals Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person: Michael Heggie, 21. He is 6'1" tall and weighs 220 pounds. Heggie is wanted on a warrant issued in Dakota County for felony assault by strangulation. Anyone with information can call 712-252-0211 or email siouxlands.mostwanted@usdoj.gov. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 28th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. There are no obituaries in today's paper, so we will be moving to the sports section. And our first story is Sioux City Explorers survive late night Claiborne comeback. The Sioux City Explorers had to burn some midnight oil because of a long rain delay, but the wait was well worth it. The Explorers built an early 5-0 lead, and that helped them beat the Claiborne Railroaders 7-6 on Sunday at the depot down in Texas. Blake Taberi had a second-inning sacrifice fly that put the Explorers on the board. Nate Sampson scored on the play, and he led off the inning with a single. Trey Martin lit the candle on the X's third-inning rally with an RBI single. That scored Danny Amaro, who had a one-out single. Later on during the inning, Tiberi earned a two-run single that scored Martin and Sampson. Sampson also had an RBI single in the inning. The Explorers had two runs in the fifth inning, and both of those came from two-out single from Chase Harris. Tyler Beardsley pitched the first four innings for the Exes. He went four innings and allowed three earned runs on six innings. Beardsley struck out four and walked three. Max Kunz earned the win out of the bullpen. He pitched two scoreless innings. He surrendered two hits and a walk. Thomas McElrath earned a two-inning save. He allowed two earned runs on four hits. McElrath also struck out three. The Explorers are 16-22 on the season, and they will have a day off on Monday. Then Sioux City starts a seven-game homestand starting at 7:05 Tuesday against Sioux Falls. The Explorers will also be at home over the holiday weekend against Winnipeg. Pair of Sioux City arms selected to All-Star Game. Sioux City Explorers pitchers Patrick Ledet and Thomas McElrath have been selected to represent the West Division in the 2022 American Association All-Star Game. This is the second year All-Star honor for Patrick Ledet. He previously was named a Frontier League All-Star in 2019, pitching for Lake Erie. This is McElrath's first All-Star selection. Ledet has been outstanding in his second season with the Sioux City Explorers. The lefty has a 2.51 ERA that ranks third in the American Association. In seven starts, he's thrown 43 innings and holds a 2-1 record, along with 37 strikeouts and 12 walks. Last season, Ledet started 19 games, going 9-6 with a 6.25 ERA in 99.1 innings, and led the Explorers with 119 strikeouts. He secured the win in the South Division wildcard game with five shutout innings against the Claiborne Railroaders. McElrath continues to further the line of dominant Sioux City Explorers closers. He currently sits third in the league with nine saves and has not blown one. He is fifth in the league with 18 appearances and holds a 2.14 ERA. He has struck out 25 batters over 21 innings and has walked six. He is a former Mets prospect who spent his first six seasons of professional baseball with the Mets organization, reaching as high as Double A. In his previous six seasons with the Mets, he had only one save. This is his first season with Sioux City. The pitchers and reserves were selected by the managers for the East and West Division teams. Chicago Dogs manager Butch Hobson selecting the East and Joe Kefalpietra selecting the West. The All-Star break will take place over the course of July 11th to 13th, with the game itself being played on July 12th at the home of the Chicago Ducks, the Impact Field in Rosemont, Illinois. Sioux City to celebrate Dave Bancroft Day on July 1st. One of Sioux City's most decorated athletes is also one of its most obscure. Dave Bancroft was born on Sioux City's west side in 1891. 81 years later, the son of Frank Bancroft and Ella Gerhart was named to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. In the long history of baseball in Sioux City, Bancroft is the only player to earn entry into the Hall of Fame, but remains unknown in his hometown. The community will bring Bancroft's story to light in a series of events on July 1st, Dave Bancroft Day in Sioux City. The day will be highlighted with special events at the Sioux City Public Museum and Lewis and Clark Park later that evening. Special guests that day will be Tom Alicia, the author of the just-released book titled Beauty at Short, that tells the story of this most unlikely Hall of Famer. In Beauty at Short, Alicia shares the story on Dave Bancroft from his days at Hopkins School in Sioux City to his death in his adopted hometown of Superior, Wisconsin. The book is packed with fascinating Bancroft stories, including his friendship with baseball icon Babe Ruth and his unlikely trek through the minor leagues that led to a 15-year career in Major League Baseball. Alicia will tell the story at a free lunch and learn at the Sioux City Public Museum at noon on Friday, July 1st. Leading up the lunch and learn, the museum will feature an expanded display of Bancroft memorabilia from Tom Alicia's private collection and the collection from the archives of the Sioux City Public Museum. Following the presentation, Alicia will sign copies of Beauty at Short for those who want to purchase the definitive story of the Sioux City Hall of Famer. Additional information may be obtained by calling the museum at 279-6174. Later that evening, the Sioux City Explorers will dedicate the Dave Bancroft Pavilion that will feature a new plaque honoring the city's premier shortstop. The pavilion, located behind the new Explorers business office at Lewis and Clark Park, will begin around 6:30 or 30 minutes before the first pitch. The Miracle League of Sioux City will also be involved in the Dave Bancroft festivities at the ballpark. All Miracle League athletes will be admitted free of charge to the July 1st game against the Winnipeg Goldeyes. One of the Miracle League's athletes will join Beauty at Short author Tom Alicia to throw out the first pitch. In addition, thanks to the generosity of Alicia and a Sioux City business, the Miracle League will receive a $10,000 donation to support its program in Sioux City. At its meeting on Monday, June 27th, Mayor Bob Scott and the Sioux City Council will officially declare July 1st, 2022 as Dave Bancroft Day in Sioux City. And our next story headline is Mercy One Western Iowa launches Military and Veterans Health Care Initiative. A veteran suffering from a sore throat could have throat cancer. A service member exhibiting signs of depression and anxiety could have undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder. Tanya Weinkoff, a family nurse practitioner at Mercy One Singing Hills Family Medicine, who also serves in the Air National Guard, said Mercy One staff at all Mercy One locations have been trained to think outside of the box when it comes to providing health care to military members and veterans in their communities. As they become acutely and critically ill, if they come in through the emergency room setting, those providers and those staff members will be able to recognize the differences that they may need to be looking for, she said. Mercy One Western Iowa launched Military and Veterans Health Care in late May. The Trinity Health System-wide initiative, which was rolled out last November, is designed to improve the military community's access to timely, quality, compassionate, and culturally competent health care. After receiving special training, healthcare providers and other staff members are able to better respond to health concerns and challenges that are unique to those populations. As part of the initiative, Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center's patient admission process has been updated so military members and veterans are identified upon arrival. Those patients receive special patriotic-themed wristbands, which alert staff to the fact that they have served or are serving. Really, all of this is just allowing us to better approach this community, Soraya Flores, supply chair supervisor for Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center, said of the training. Within the military and all of its branches, they live off of a code of conduct. Depending on what that code is will depend on the branch. There's different ranks and very rigid rules, and those can also extend onto those service members' lives and their family members' lives as well. In addition to ongoing training about U.S. military service cultures, the initiative also includes education about common diseases, injuries, and exposures experienced by active duty and deployed service members and veterans. Weinkoff said post-traumatic stress disorder and prostate cancer, which Agent Orange exposure is a potential risk of, are examples. Some health problems younger veterans are experiencing have been tied to burn pits, which were used to dispose of discarded food, human waste, chemicals, munitions, and other items in Iraq and Afghanistan. The toxic smoke can affect the skin, eyes, respiratory, and cardiovascular systems, gastrointestinal tract, and internal organs, according to the Veterans Administration. We are seeing that those are really close to what they're comparing to Agent Orange for our newer veterans, said Flores, who served 7 years in the Army National Guard and 1 year in the Army Reserve Unit. Her service included a tour in Afghanistan. Weinkoff noted that not all military members or veterans are eligible to use the VA healthcare system. Even if they are eligible, they may not be enrolled, or there may be a long list or waiting time to be going into their primary care, so therefore they're outsourced within the local community, she said. Flores said the VA actually only serves 12.2% of males and 20.6% of females who have served in the military. We actually have 80% of our community that's getting care within community care, she said. When Mercy One Sing and Heal staff encounter a veteran or a current military member in need at the clinic, they may refer the patient to Weinkauf. She asks the patient what branch of the military they served in, what their job was, where they were stationed, if they were ever deployed, and what they did for annual training. She uses military terms and lingo, which she said helps the patient open up. They complain of knee pain, but I don't look at it just as knee pain. What did you do when you were in the military? Were you a jumper? Were you airborne? Did you have chronic wear and tear on your knees? She said. Let's say we have someone newly diagnosed with prostate cancer. Did you serve in Vietnam? Were you exposed to Agent Orange? Are you connected with the VA system? It helps lead them to the correct care or the proper care that they should be receiving. Flora said it's important to recognize the needs of military family members as well. It's because of this course that I've had a few colleagues identify themselves to some of the lead paint exposures on bases they lived in when they were younger, some of the contaminated water levels in North Carolina that they were exposed to. So there's a lot there that's being offered, not only for veterans, but their family members and their children, she said. This coming Saturday is Saturday in the Park, and so we have an article or two about that. Our first one, Saturday in the Park's Kind of Guy, Buddy Guy returns for Third Fest. Buddy Guy has been a feature in American music for decades and will make his third appearance at Saturday in the Park this year. Guy first performed in 1993 and again in 2004. In a review of his 2004 show, Guy staked his claim to Mr. Saturday in the Park title and should have a permanent slot on the Saturday in the Park roster. He is what it's all about. Chances are you have heard his guitar riffs and vocals on either solo tracks or collaborations with other artists such as Eric Clapton, Fleetwood Mac, Jeff Beck, and B.B. King. But if that still doesn't ring a bell, here is some additional background on the blues musician. Hailing from Lettsworth, Louisiana, George Buddy Guy is best known for a combination of Chicago blues and rock and roll. Chicago blues uses a harmonica or electric guitar distorted through an amplifier, with drums and bass supplying the rhythm. His guitar playing has been called ferocious and visceral. Legendary musicians such as Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix have cited the 85-year-old as an influence. In 1986, Clapton went so far as to say that Guy is, without a doubt, the best guitar player alive. It took a little over 20 years for Guy to earn his first big hit in the United States when he released his seventh studio album, Damn Right I've Got the Blues, in 1991. The album won him his first Grammy, taking home the 1992 Best Contemporary Blues Album. Since then, Guy has been nominated for 6 more Grammys, taking home 5 of them. Guy has produced 18 studio albums as well as 6 live albums in his 63-year career. 6 of Guy's albums have charted in the top 100 of the Billboard 200. Those albums are Skin Deep in 2008, Living Proof 2011, Rhythm and Blues 2013, Born to Play Guitar 2015, and The Blues is Alive and Well in 2018. Additionally, 6 of Guy's albums spent time as the number one blues albums on Billboard's charts. Those albums are Sweet Tea, Skin Deep, Living Proof, Rhythm and Blues, Born to Play Guitar, and The Blues is Alive and Well. Guy Stone Crazy, off his 1979 album Stone Crazy, was named the 78th greatest guitar song of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. Guy is also a National Medal of Arts and Kennedy Center honoree and was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2005. The Rock Hall writes, "If you cut Buddy Guy open, he would bleed blue." Guy owns a blues club in downtown Chicago, Buddy Guy's Legends. The club, which opened in 1989, often features up-and-coming blues musicians. It has also hosted its fair share of stars, such as Willie Dixon, B.B. King, the Rolling Stones, David Bowie, and Guy himself. We'll now move to an article that's titled, A Conversation with Saturday in the Park co-founder David Bernstein. A few days ago, a buddy sent Saturday in the Park co-founder David Bernstein a YouTube version of Paradise Theater, the 10th album by the rock band Styx. The 1981 concept album was presented as a fictional account of Chicago's Paradise Theater from its heyday in 1920 to its eventual closing decades later. Featuring classic tracks like The Best of Times, Too Much Time on My Hand, and Nothing Ever Goes as Planned. Watching the Paradise Theater video brought back a lot of memories for Bernstein, whose first concert was, in fact, Styx when they played in Omaha. I was 15 years old at the time of the concert and probably should not have been there, he said. Yet the concert concept of a decaying theater as depicted in songs like Halfpenny Twopenny and AD 1958 stuck with Bernstein. In fact, it helped in his future efforts to restore Sioux City's legendary Orpheum Theater. It was also a motivation when Bernstein co-founded Saturday in the Park with his friend Adam Feigs more than 30 years ago. Is Saturday in the Park 32 years old now, or is it 33 years, Bernstein asked himself. Due to COVID, who can do the math anymore? Coming off of 2021's wildly successful two-day Saturday in the Park, featuring AJR and John Fogerty, Bernstein said this year's show snuck up on him. 2021 was so refreshing. Everyone was ready to get outside and enjoy everything, especially a free music festival where everything just gelled, he said. This year, it seems a bit different. There seems to be a lot of angst and maybe some hopelessness in the air with everyone still scrambling. Nevertheless, it seemed like a good time for a free festival with a full lineup of amazing performers. Looking through this year's slate of performers, Bernstein mentioned the return of the Abbott Brothers. The Abbotts gave one of the best Saturday in the Park shows of all time, he said. Bernstein also praises legendary guitarist Buddy Guy, who at 85 will be making his third appearance. You cannot get any better than Buddy Guy, he said. Plus, Bernstein said when singer Ella King hits Grandview Park's main stage, she will knock everyone's socks off. Elle's going to be awesome, he said. A few weeks before Saturday in the Park, Bernstein continued to work on many of the behind-the-scenes details. Yet, he said the festival would not be possible without the support of its sponsors or without the hard work of Saturday in the Park's committee members and countless numbers of volunteers. Some years things gel, while other years things drag until the last minute. However, by the time the Saturday nears to the 4th of July rolls around, everything seems to work out. After all, everyone knows that Saturday in the Park will always represent a good time for a free festival with amazing performers giving terrific shows. Watching a YouTube video of Styx from their Paradise Theater tour, Bernstein noted the visual quality was grainy, but the music was shockingly excellent. Paradise Theater has withstood the test of time. The same can be said of Saturday in the Park. Now we have a story about one of the other performers, and it's King talks about being a woman in the music field and finding her voice in country. When people used to ask Ellie King what her genre was, she'd say, "I don't know, you tell me." That's because she has a musical style that encompasses everything from rock, soul, country, and blues. Best known for her rootsy, retro Grammy-nominated debut single, X's and O's, King has even performed duets with such country music heavy hitters as Dierks Bentley and Miranda Lambert. Which may be surprising since King, the daughter of comedian Rob Schneider and model London King, doesn't look like much of a country girl. Even though she was born in Los Angeles and spent her teen years between New York and Philadelphia, King also lived in Ohio, where her stepdad gave her a record by the legendary all-female punk group The Donnas. By the time she turned 13, King started playing guitar while listening to everything from Aretha to Al Green to AC/DC. "As a very little girl, I was totally into soul, hip-hop, and disco," she explained. "Growing up, I appreciated any music I could get my hands on." Well, her initial forays into music walked a fine line between crunchy rock and roll as well as swinging soul. King insisted country is the genre where she felt the most creative. "Why country? Because it's badass, that's why," she answered with a husky laugh. Having said that, King's coming out as a country singer hasn't always been a smooth one. "My first experience in Nashville was when I was in my mid-20s," the now 32-year-old remembered. "They pretty much chewed me up and spit me out." King said this was because producers viewed her as a pretty girl and not as a serious singer, songwriter, and musician. "Is it tough to be a woman in a music industry?" she asked. "Yeah, it's getting better, but it can get rough when you don't fall neatly into any perceived cookie-cutter category." Still, King admitted she was the one who always stood in her way when it came to success. "Artists are usually their own biggest hurdles," she said. "Guess I'm no different." Yet during COVID, King did the most creative thing she could do. I had a baby, and he was born in September 2021, she explained. When the music world and everything else came to a screeching halt, I brought a new life to my life. Since then, King has been writing more music and returning to touring, and she sprained her ankle. I may be on crutches at Saturday in the Park, but I'll be ready to rock, she said with a chuckle. That is, unless I broke anything else in the meantime. We'll now move to a business story in its headline, Just Keep Your Returns, Store Away, Paying You Not to Bring Back Unwanted Items. The chaotic mix of record fuel prices and an unending supply chain crisis have retailers considering the unthinkable. Instead of returning your unwanted items, just keep them. In recent weeks, some of the biggest store chains, including Target, Walmart, Gap, American Eagle Outfitters, and others, have reported in their latest earnings calls that they have too much inventory of stuff ranging from workout clothes, springtime jackets, and hoodies to garden furniture and bulky kids' toys. It's costing them tons of money to store it. Now, add on to that glut another category of product that stores have to deal with, returns. So, instead of piling returned merchandise into this growing inventory heap, stores are considering just handing customers their money back and letting them hang on to the stuff they don't want. It would be a smart strategic initiative, said Bert Flickinger, retail expert and managing director of retail consultancy Strategic Resource Group. Retailers are stuck with excess inventory of unprecedented levels. They cannot afford to take back even more of it. Return products are handled in a number of different ways, he said. Retailers take back merchandise from the customer, evaluate it, and if it's in good condition, put it back on the shelf at the same or lesser price. They can refurbish damaged returns and sell them for less or offload them to liquidators to resell. They also can sell return products to foreign liquidators in Europe, Canada, or Mexico. Given the situation at the ports and the container shortages, sending products overseas isn't really an option. Lastly, retailers can hire third-party firms to handle all aspects of merchandise returns for them. Each of these options, however, tack on additional costs for retailers. Flickinger said, for every dollar in sales, a retailer's net profit is between a cent to 5 cents. With returns, for every dollar in return merchandise, it costs a retailer between 15 cents to 30 cents to handle it. There is one other option for retailers to address returns while avoiding more product bloat, and that's to consider a returnless return, says Steve Ropp, chief operating officer with GoTRG, a firm that processes over 100 million returned items annually for companies like Walmart, Amazon, and Lowe's. Just keep it. Rob said his company's clients are 100% considering offering the keep it option for returns this year, although he would not discuss if any of his customers have implemented the keep it returns policy yet. In some instances, when they determined it would be easier, some retailers advised customers to just keep or donate their return after issuing a refund. Walmart said it had nothing to share at this time. Lowe's did not provide a comment for the story. They're already discounting in stores to clear out products, but when there's heavy discounting, buyer's remorse goes up. People are tempted to buy a lot to only return it later, he said. Refunding customers while simultaneously letting them keep their returns isn't a new practice, said Rob. It started with Amazon several years ago. The offer makes sense for some types of products. Lower price tier bulky items like furniture, kitchen appliances, home decor, baby chairs, walkers, strollers, where it's costly for the retailer to cover the shipping costs for the return. Other products like kids' toys, footwear, towels, and bedding raise sanitary concerns when it comes to returns. It could also apply to those categories, he said. Another concern with cheaper items. Stores typically discount return products, so the amount of money they can make on an inexpensive return is minuscule and may not be worth the trade-off, said Keith Daniels, partner with Karl Marx Advisors. Still, a keep-it policy has its own disadvantages, namely, companies will need to ensure that they don't become victims of fraud. One thing retailers need to track and ensure is that customers that become aware of the keep-it policy do not begin to abuse it by seeking free merchandise over a series of orders by getting a refund, but getting to keep the merchandise, said Daniels. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Tuesday, June 28th. I'm your reader, Dagna. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.